Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Technology can be a boon or a bane. That applies to almost all technological innovations, and it usually depends on how and where that technology is used. When I was a kid in school, transistor radios with tiny headphones were new. Unlike previous radios, they were small, pocket-sized. Sometimes kids would use them in questionable ways, like smuggling them into their bedrooms at night to listen to faraway radio stations instead of sleeping. Am I telling tales on myself here? Or during the World Series season, bringing them into classrooms to listen to afternoon games instead of paying attention to the teachers. When those radios were discovered, they were usually confiscated until the end of the school day. Well, today's equivalent may be the cell phone, something more powerful than a transistor radio could ever hope to be. They are the world in our pockets, with multiple means of two-way communication, access to immediate news and information of all kinds, and in the classroom, a source of distraction and often a way to cheat. Teachers face a lot of challenges, from dealing with ever-changing metrics used to judge the impact of their efforts to having to deal with the culture wars, and now, add cell phones. 70% of high school teachers around the country say distraction from cell phones is a major problem in the classroom. Cell phone restrictions have grown in response, including here in North Carolina. But some parents want their kids to have access to their phones while in school, just in case. It's a debate going on right now, and one we'll look at this hour with James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. He is here along with Krista Glaziski, executive director of the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University, and Mary Alford, a psychologist at Alfred Baker and Associates in California and founder of Resilience Across Borders. That's a nonprofit charity promoting mental health services to young people. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. Thank you, Mike.
So, James, I want to start with you. Your predecessor in your position as education reporter, a longtime education reporter, Ann Doss Helms, who retired recently, reported last year, or in 2023, excuse me, that CMS had said that cell phone use will not be tolerated in class. That rule has always been evidently on the books, but it began to be a problem, particularly after the pandemic. Have things changed since she wrote that in 2023? What is the rule on cell phones in classrooms at Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools?
Yeah, so generally speaking, the district has, like you mentioned, kind of a district-wide rule saying that cell phones are not allowed in classes. But generally speaking, it's kind of left up to each individual school to decide how they want to enforce and implement that. So you can kind of see different approaches, across the spectrum from school to school. I had done a story earlier back in the fall about Myers Park High School, which, for instance, has a locker in every classroom where students can come in at the beginning of the class. They put their phone in the locker. It gets locked away for the class period, and then when they leave, they can take their phone with them, so they have access to it, in between classes and during lunch and things like that. There are other schools, though, for instance, that might have an off and away policy where they don't want to see it at all during the day, or sometimes different kinds of approaches like that. It kind of varies from school to school.
And in let's just talk about CMS first. At CMS, what is their reasoning for not allowing cell phones allegedly in the classroom?
Yeah, over the last couple of years, and you mentioned Ann Doss Helms, and she had kind of reported on this last year a little bit, there had been kind of some incidents of distraction, of cyberbullying, things like that. So they kind of wanted to firm up the enforcement. Like you mentioned, this has been on the books for a while, but they wanted to kind of reinforce it among their schools that there should be some sort of policy mechanism in place to regulate this better. In terms of why kind of the school-by-school approach, what administration had told me was that they liked the idea of kind of giving their principals and trusting their principals to have the autonomy in each school to figure out what works best for their school community.
Why would it be different? That was going to be my next question. If they have a policy at CMS where they don't want cell phones in the classroom, and they're going to leave it up to individual schools, therefore the principals in those schools, to make their own decisions, and perhaps the principals pass it down the line and leave it up to individual teachers about the policy. Why have the policy?
Yeah, I think the logic is to say that each school might be different, might have different needs.
How could it be different?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on maybe some of the resources that are available to each school. You know, for instance, that locker policy that I mentioned at Myers Park, you know, was done in part with help from the PTSO. Some of that may not be existing in other schools across the district. But generally speaking, you know, again, what I heard from administration is just that they like the idea that it gives principals the autonomy to kind of govern this and see what works best for their schools. And speaking to their families and speaking to their students, you might have different parents who maybe want them banned versus other parents who maybe are, like you had mentioned earlier, like having access to their kids during the day or want their kids to have access to a phone just in case or something like that. It kind of could vary. I mean, there's a lot of different views on this issue as we're going to talk about. And I think that the approach is to try to kind of allow for that flexibility to meet parents and students where they are at each individual building.
Krista Klazuski is with us. She's with the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation. It could be argued, I suppose, that cell phones are an educational innovation, or they're certainly a technological one. And I know you want to chime in on this. Krista, go ahead.
Well, yeah, sure. Just by way of introduction, let me kind of start from the position that I'm taking. As part of where I'm coming from, I started as a classroom teacher, and I taught middle school for a number of years. But I will add to that conversation, I did not teach, not even in this century. I was a teacher in the 1900s. And so this was not part of the conversation that we were having at that time. But we were having the kinds of conversations that I think could be analogous to the ones today. How do we best create learning experiences for students? What are the kinds of learning goals that we want to drive students to? And how do we get there? And these are age-old conversations that I think we're continuing to work out. Now, what cell phones have done is introduced a new form of technology in the classroom. And I think it's important to understand or to acknowledge that a cell phone is not a monolith. It is a device that delivers any number of applications to our hands and our pockets and our eyes, some of which could be very distracting and some of which could be very useful. For some kids, this is the only calculator that they have in their pocket. And so when I see a district like Charlotte-Mecklenburg saying, let's let the principals decide on the best policies to serve their students, what I hear is that we are not trying to create one-size-fits-all solutions in instances where a school wants kids to have access to a note-taking device or a calculator or an informational resource that might look different to another school that would be saying, here's a different kind of device or a number of devices for those purposes.
And 30 years ago, we might have been doing this program today on calculators in the classroom, because I remember that argument as well. James,
absolutely.
CMS is the second largest school system in the state, Wake County being the largest up in Raleigh. But there are other school systems around the Charlotte area. What is their approach to this from your knowledge of all of this? And what about the charter schools and the private schools in the area?
Yeah, I mean, there really is a pretty wide spectrum of different approaches in terms of the policies that different districts have in place. You mentioned Wake County. As of now, they don't have any kind of district-wide policy. They kind of leave it up to each school to set their own policy. But that's something that they are looking at changing right now. I believe they just brought on a consultant to help them kind of come up with a district-wide policy. Over in Union County, they have sort of a blanket off-and-away ban for lower grades, elementary and middle school. But then at the high school level, they allow for some flexibility in terms of being able to take your phone out in between classes and at lunch. What I think is interesting is looking at some school districts across the state who are taking maybe some more creative or flexible approaches. I know Hoke County Schools, they have a policy written in their policy that teachers are allowed to use phones for instructional purposes if they have, you know, something, you know, that they want to use a phone for. And then if you look at Brunswick County, they actually have Yonder pouches, which are these magnetic pouches that are given to students. You can put the phone in the pouch. The student can't access the pouch during the day, but it allows them to keep their phone on them. And if they have a need for the phone, they can go to school staff who can, you know, unlock the pouch and give it to them. So there really is a broad spectrum of approaches on this.
Krista, as maybe you can't answer this question, I don't know, but as you look around the country, what is the average policy with regard to these items in the classroom?
Well, it really does run a diverse range, and there is not one average policy. But I would offer that I think that it's important to acknowledge that boundaries are good in our daily lives. There are times that we sit in meetings and we want to have cell phones off and everyone says, put phones away, all eyes, let's look at each other, let's deal with this. I think that it's most important to acknowledge boundaries in all of our instances are good to have, and they are good conversations to be having. And the older that kids get and that youth become, we want to empower them to think critically and reflectively about the devices in their pockets, about the ways that they're engaging the world. And I think that those are really critical conversations that we as adults could be having with each other, and we could be having and engaging with kids as well.
I mentioned that the use of cell phones really began to pick up after the pandemic, because it certainly actually happened in the pandemic when kids were at home learning virtually and they had their devices with them and you really couldn't control it. Computers certainly became the tool to bring the classroom into the home during the pandemic. Students have become accustomed to having access to their phones. Can you put the genie back in the bottle?
I would say two things again to kind of complicate how we think about this issue, or in other words, maybe let's bring a lot of curiosity to this issue. So I'll reiterate something that I've already touched on. Cell phones are not a monolith. We have a cell phone in our pocket that delivers applications. Many of those applications are intended to drive our attention. And as soon as we have, we are finding ourselves and our attention driven in a certain direction, then we do have reason to believe we don't want this to be a distraction from learning. However, we also have to acknowledge that if we are talking about cell phones or a removal of cell phones, asking the question curiously, is that going to solve the problem that we think it is solving? I imagine that we're going to get to the issue of student mental health and mental health unused in today's program. And I don't want to maybe jump ahead to that, but I would like to offer that that if we are trying to, for example, create different kinds of opportunities for learning, or we really want to increase mental wellness among youth, those are really important conversations to be having. I think cell phones can be one part of the picture, but I don't think that they deserve the blame wholesale for everything that we are concerned about.
And we are going to get to the psychological aspect of this, and that's why we invited Mary Alford to be with us. She is a psychologist and with the Resilience Across Borders, which helps young people deal with their problems. Just in general, before we talk about the mental health side of this, Mary, are we being hysterical about this because it's a new technology that wasn't here 10 years ago or 15 years ago, or even in some cases 4 years ago, because parents maybe have relented on their children begging them to give them access to phones? Are we being hysterical about this, making too much of it?
I think we have to recognize that extreme to complex problems are not usually the best avenue to take. And, you know, I have been around long enough to see when video games were blamed for everything. You know, it caused aggression, it caused addiction. And, well, yes, in certain cases, it does impact mental health, but are they using devices because of mental health issues, or are they causing? So,
television used to be blamed, and before that, it was radio that was blamed. So maybe that's why I asked the question, and we'll explore that and other aspects of cell phones in the classroom when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cell phones in the classrooms and the debate that has been ensuing in educational circles and among parents and students and others about that for several years now. James Farrell is WFAE News education reporter. He's joining us along with Mary Alford, a psychologist and founder of Resilience Across Borders, which is a nonprofit promoting mental health services to young people. And Krista Glazewski is with us. She's executive director of the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University. Krista, you have said that, quote, we have a history of seeing bans occur and then kind of changing our mind about it or rethinking it. And you think that we should have an open mind about these things. Is that because, like every new technology, it really does take us time to assess the impact of that technology, to get our arms around it, really understand it, and use it in ways that become beneficial rather than harmful to us?
Yeah, right before the break, I'll echo what Mary said. You know, we do often want to place a lot of blame on the technologies that we have concern for. So is it video games? You know, I'm of the generation where television was going to rot my brain. And and I will point out that we rarely go back and check on the brain rot or the video game violence. We don't, we rarely kind of forecast there, you know, did television rot Gen X's brain? I think arguably not. And so I do approach this with a lot of curiosity, a lot of caution, and a lot of instance taking, by which I mean, what are the cases that we can see and understand that cell phones might be usable and useful in, for example, a learning environment? And what are the cases where we want to draw some clear boundaries around that? In all of those cases, I think require conversation, curiosity, talking to youth directly about their cell phone and their relationship with cell phones. I encourage everyone who's a parent or a teacher or works with youth in youth group or community or coach to start talking to youth. What is your relationship with your phone? And maybe not, that's not the opening question that'll get youth talking to you, but it is if you ask them about their favorite apps, what they like to do, how they communicate with their friends, and acknowledge that the world has changed from the world we grew up in, that it is not a different form of communication, that this is their form of communication, and it is their form of connection and a form of engagement.
Yeah, they used to call the TV the idiot box, and the people calling it the idiot box were probably people who said it was the idiot box because they would prefer you to read. And they forgot that reading books were technology. They were technological innovations at one point in our time, distant past, I guess. James, where schools have forbidden the use of cell phones, are they noticing better student performance? Where they have allowed cell phones, are they noticing worse student performance?
Yes, school leadership in places that have put in different kinds of policies like this, generally the ones that I've spoken to or I've heard about have had good reviews of their policies. I know in Myers Park, they're really happy with their locker policy. And I've spoken to some students and I've spoken to PTSO members who felt that they saw improvements, that they felt that it helped with issues like disciplinary, you know, actions and things like that. I spoke to one student who said that not having it in the classroom and knowing that it's not even like kind of in their pocket is something that could buzz, help them focus a little bit more. And if they finished work early, it encouraged them to maybe be a little more social in the classroom and get some work done. I know over in Granville County Schools, which has a pretty strict off and away policy, they've talked a lot about you know, disciplinary and suspensions and things like that all going down since instituting the policy. You know, I don't know how much of that is a causal relationship. But at the same time, I mean, when you talk to the people who have instituted these kinds of policies, you generally hear good things, that they feel that it helped students engage more. You know, at the same time, when you talk to people who want to try to encourage students to maybe learn how to use technology more responsibly and have found creative ways to do that, you know, My sense is that they would argue that that they've liked having those opportunities for their students as well.
Mary, in addition to all the other things I've said about your background, you also work as excuse me, as a clinician with the American Psychological Association, and you have been helping craft healthy technology use recommendations. You believe, I understand, that any broad bans against cell phone use create new disciplinary issues and ignore the reality of the technology. Talk about that.
So I'm just to clarify, I don't work for the American Psychological Association, but I am a clinician primarily and at Alvord Baker. But I've been part of the expert task force committee to outline some pros and cons. And I think my personal, and I think the committee would agree, is that we need to look at all aspects, both the helpful potential aspects as well as the difficulties. When we talk about bans, we talk about legislatures usually, which is different than schools coming up or school systems even coming up with their own policies that they may. And when schools do it, it can be more flexibility. You know, as Krista mentioned, there are some students with learning issues that may need to use a computer or some other device as an aid. So we don't want to make such policies that we box ourselves in. And that's, you know, a concern.
You've also compared the approach to banning cell phones to that of banning books. You say that when you ban books, you miss out on a lot of good literature if you don't actually teach media literacy. And you can certainly provide students with help understanding how to best use technology. And that obviously is something that should be done in the classroom because it's part of our lives now. But how does that aid in education at large?
Well, you know, I think that what I would like to see is more media literacy and now digital literacy taught at school. So simply taking something away doesn't mean the kids are not going to have workarounds. They still have access to computers in schools and still can figure out how to access so many things. So what they need to learn, and school is like an equal opportunity place for kids to learn the skills of how do you discern incorrect factual information from disinformation? How do you respond if you are in an app and it's taking you down some dark rabbit hole, which then can affect mental health? How? Now, I'm not saying it should be taught in every class, you know, but there should be some focus on that in schools, just as we teach them schools. Resilience is the ability to adapt to challenging situations, but you also have to have agency and input. And of course, as kids get older, they're going to make more decisions and they need to be part of that conversation. So it's
that's media literacy. And just as the transistor radio example that I used at the top of the program, we used to also sneak comic books in to the classroom and we put them inside our textbooks. Textbooks would be up on the desk open and the comic book is what we were reading inside the textbook. So there's always been this problem of bifurcated attention. But with these cell phones, you could be using them for educational purposes. You could be using them for the assignment that you're working on in the classroom right now with the teacher's permission. Or you could be surfing the web or checking out TikTok or texting each other across the classroom. If the phone is there, rules or no rules, won't students always find ways to use them that are distracting and counterproductive?
So I'll jump in here. I think that the answer to that question, if you're asking it in that way, is yes. Every person with a cell phone in front of them can use it as a distraction. That is how cell phones are designed. They send us alerts, they send us pings, they send us information. We are getting information from all sides. So I think that it is important to have conversations around, well, what are the boundaries we want to set around this? And to empower learners, like Mary was saying, with some agency here, and to talk about, well, what is the kind of learning environment that we are creating, and how do we drive to the kinds of learning outcomes that we are identifying and want to see kids perform at? And that's a great conversation to be happening.
James, in your conversation with teachers, I would think this is very disconcerting for teachers in schools where they don't have a policy where they can take the phone away from their students and the students have them out. And I have heard from teachers who say they look out and they see a sea of tops of heads because everybody's got their head bowed to their cell phone and they're not listening to the teacher at the front of the room. What if teachers told you about this?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that same concern, a lot of frustration about maybe sometimes when cell phones become a problem in the classroom, how that affects learning and how that affects, you know, their trying to go over their curriculum and accomplish the things they want to accomplish with their students. At the same time, you also hear teachers who get maybe a little concerned or frustrated about having to sort of be the disciplinary arm on this, right? When it's left to the classroom level, the teacher is the one that's in charge of taking the phone away or implementing, you know, the enforcement. If that's the kind of policy that's there, sometimes teachers get frustrated with having to take on this new role in addition to what they're trying to do in the classroom from a teaching perspective of kind of becoming the phone police. That sometimes becomes a concern among teachers who, you know, and that's some of the teachers I spoke to, and to go back to Myers Park, because that's the school I spent the most time in, they enjoyed the fact that it was kind of just locked away for the class period time, and it was an easier thing to kind of enforce and police, and it wasn't something that, you know, was kind of different from classroom to classroom, where maybe some students have figured out, oh, this teacher is more lenient here, or this teacher is less lenient, or things like that. So I think sometimes teachers appreciate having kind of that kind of a policy that gives them clear direction in terms of how to enforce this, so that it's not another responsibility that they have to be thinking about in the classroom.
Krista, the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation, which is whom you work for, they've held discussions with educators, yes, and parents and public health experts and others on this very topic, on cell phones in schools. Are you hearing different opinions from these various different stakeholders as you've had these conversations? Is everybody for it? Is everybody against it? Or is it a completely mixed bag?
I'm hearing different opinions coming from the same people in the same 5-minute time span. I mean, I think we all wear multiple hats in this conversation. I speak as a researcher, as an educator, and as the leader of the Friday Institute. I also speak as a parent of a middle school student, and someone that has to engage with conversations on a daily basis around this push-pull around device, this device in our hands. And the very first time that you set a boundary around cell phones not used in this moment, like dinner table is a common conversation you'll be having at home. The second that happens, and the second the parent reaches for the phone, that middle school kid is going to chime in and say, ah, caught you, mom, right? And so I think it's important that we are all walking many different kinds of perspectives and wearing lots of hats in this conversation. But I'll point to a few specifics, because I think there are some things that were takeaways from our conversations we've been having at the Friday Institute that really stand out to me. I think that, as Mary has alluded to, and James as well, that the second we start talking about a wholesale ban, we have created camps, and we've invited people to take an immediate position that they start to try to defend. But rather than talking about it as a ban, and we talk about it as, where are we driving to? What do we want to see? Then we have we are inviting a different kind of conversation. With younger and younger children, we actually aren't talking as much about cell phones as we are about screens and screen time. And some research is pointing to some special concerns around the ways in which screens might be activating reward centers of the brain at critical points in young children's development. And we don't know yet what that may or may not lead to at later points in life, but we want to make sure that children are experiencing the opportunity to develop their body, their engagement, their play in the world, in the real world, with conversation in the real world, as an example of something that we want to think about.
Dr. Alford, a 2023 Gallup poll a Gallup study found that 51% of American teenagers use social media for about 4 hours a day. So isn't taking a mandatory break from the device that allows that communication a good thing?
You know, I think the Gallup poll and others are finding that the average is about 4, a little bit less than 4, and those who use it more than that, it affects their mental health, right? But does it affect their mental health, or they're using it to avoid other things? And I guess what I would say is, you know, we need to make sure that, and piggyback on what Krista said, that there's moderation. There need to be boundaries. There need to be some limits. And I see adults having difficulty with this, and parents are role models. And if we can't put away our phones to have a conversation, it's difficult. But are bans the answer, or are there certain restrictions that can happen. For example,
But is it a ban? We don't allow them to bring in. I can't even use the word magazine because nobody takes magazines anymore. But we wouldn't allow that 10 years ago. We wouldn't have allowed them to watch television in the classroom if that was even a possibility. Right. 10 years ago, we wouldn't have allowed them to bring in a comic book or a novel to read. That what's the difference?
Well,
it's
I
not
think
banning them, do, it's just saying it's inappropriate use in a place. I'm sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
We do know that there is evidence now that the cell phones are distracting, particularly in places of learning, and that we want to focus. We also, the data is coming in that it can preclude social interactions like during lunchtime, where for younger kids, middle school, some even still have recess time. So we want to make sure that there is balance and that there are boundaries. So I can't say, I think that we're still exploring and we're still learning this. But yes, they can't just have free cell phone use in the classroom. But they do have computers. And how are those monitored, right? So they're workarounds. I think that we need to look at content, context, what is going on, what is the purpose of the use, and then what are the rules and regulations. It's certainly easier, I think, on teachers, I would suspect, as James said, that if there's one rule and it's the school rule to enforce. As a psychologist, I also worry about those children who might need some accommodations, and so there needs to be some flexibility built in.
If there is, and I'm assuming that there is, empirical evidence that there's a negative impact on cell phone use in the classroom, unless it's being used properly and under supervision by the teacher, if there is that evidence out there, and there is evidence that it's an impact on mental health, the use of these phones in young people, why wouldn't it be a good idea to say you can't use it from 9 to 3? I have 20 seconds.
You know, I'm not a policymaker, but I would think that certain classes might use it. And so I would advocate for flexibility.
And we have to take a break. We'll come back with more on this and a lot more on this, actually, in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cell phone use in the classroom, various policies. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Mary Alford is with us. Dr. Mary Alford is a psychologist with Alford Baker & Associates in San Diego and founder of Resilience Across Borders. Krista Glazuski is executive director of the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at North Carolina State University. And James Farrell is WFAE News education reporter. James, we know that cell phones are addictive. They are designed to be addictive, particularly the apps that are on the cell phones. And young people are constantly on their phones, using them for anything but to make a phone call. By allowing the use of these devices in the classroom, are we providing de facto support to an addictive habit, no matter the benefits?
I think it's a complicated issue. You know, cell phones, you know, we were talking a little bit before about magazines and TVs. The difference between cell phones is that they serve so many different functions. It's not just, you know, a magazine or, you know, a thing that you read. So I think with people who have supported the use of cell phones in classrooms would probably say that if you regulate it correctly, if you're supervising correctly, especially with younger kids and things like that, that it can be a benefit. I mean, and we talked a little bit before about Chromebooks and one-to-one devices. I mean, we have seen the ways in which technology can create positive benefits in the classroom without becoming overly addictive. So I think there's opportunity there. But at the same time, you know, I don't really know what the research shows in terms of whether allowing these things in classrooms then adds to, you know, addictive behavior or things like that.
I'll ask Mary Alford that question in a second, but first, Krista wanted to chime in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I'll also add to this that, you know, I think we all, if we caught the Surgeon General's report on youth mental health and wellness in December, I think there's concern. We are increasingly concerned about these increasing rates of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation among youth, full stop. And in that report, nowhere are cell phones mentioned. And I think it's just important to remember that the research points to kind of a constellation of issues and factors, and these are co-occurring among the many challenges that youth may face. And I think that, you know, when we want to have the conversation around mental health, we have to also have the conversation about, you know, kind of individual differences and identities and family and community and society and our environment and all the ways in which those factors act on mental health, mental wellness.
Mary, let me get your take on, are we encouraging the use of an addictive device, even if we use it for educational purposes in the classroom?
Let me first clarify, I am sitting in San Diego, but I'm actually licensed and practice in Maryland, so I don't get in trouble with any boards. You know, I think addiction is a strong word. I like to use overuse so that we can really then decide and determine what are all the factors. And as Krista pointed out, and James, it's a complicated issue. And mental health really does suffer when the devices are used excessively and when they are also used in social media platforms, which brings me to the other issue. The platforms need to take some responsibility in terms of making them safer for youth.
Well, we know that is not going to happen. In fact, the inverse of that is going to happen in within the next 6 months.
At least for now, but hopefully the tide will turn and maybe that will happen. I'm optimistic in the future because I think there'll be enough of a push when there are dangers. You know, as a clinician, I see benefits for kids who are, you know, broader than just in school, are marginalized LGBT kids who find support, you know, online. There are kids who are socially anxious, and it's a venue to start conversations. On the other hand, the mental health issues are of concern. And when we see overuse, then we have to look at what else is not going on in their lives. You know, what is the family situation? Are they, do they have in-person friends, which is critical, and we sort of have a loneliness crisis now as well.
James.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing on the question of overuse. I think that for schools that have put in some sort of policy that allows for cell phones in between classes and at lunch, what I've heard from them is that they feel that that gives students the opportunity to kind of learn how to maybe schedule their use or regulate their use a little bit more. You know, understanding that there are certain periods of the day where you should not be looking at your phone at all, and it's not appropriate in that particular setting. Being able to then have it again, you know, when it is appropriate, and then being able to tear away from it again when it comes time to buckle down and focus. So I think some of those policies have kind of aimed to look at that side of it, of the overuse side, and try to regulate use among students a little bit more and kind of teach them how to structure their cell phone use.
Well, let's talk about how to use these devices productively in the classroom. Krista, you believe that incorporating phones into the educational experience can help students learn more responsible use of technology, and certainly that is going to become increasingly valuable as time goes on. Has anyone seen that happen anywhere around the country?
Yeah, I think the research doesn't actually suggest that. I think the research suggests that there are limited uses and specific use cases. As we've mentioned, we've talked about cell phones as calculators and translation devices and assistive technologies and information and all of those things. I mean, I have my own middle school kid submitted an assignment because I'd forgotten to earlier in the day, like, I got to finish this, submit it, went online, wrote the reflection and submitted it while we were out at dinner. And so I think that it's just important to remember that these are some of the use cases where we are glad to have these types of technologies at our disposal. I want to do a little future casting as well and just say a couple things, you know, about the idea, returning to the idea about, you know, teaching these kinds of media literacy and engagement skills, these digital skills for future productivity. Kids are not going to turn 18 and suddenly be capable of managing multiple calendars and schedules and apps that we need for our own productivity as a contributor to society and the workforce. And so we want to kind of teach these skills and these management of our apps that we use for productivity at when it's a developmentally appropriate to do so. And then finally, I'll say that, you know, in the future, these devices are going to take on new roles and new lives. And we want kids now to be equipped to be the developers someday.
Media literacy has become increasingly important in this new world where traditional media has begun to collapse a little bit, or actually a lot in many cases, and people are getting their news from unvetted sources, and they don't understand what that means. They just think if it's there on the screen, it must be true. It is 90% of the time not true. And the same thing is true, I guess, of social media, because people are talking to each other and they're spreading what essentially would be gossip over the backyard fence, it seems to me. So teaching literacy with how to use a cell phone is going to become increasingly important as the Wild West nature of the internet has become even more so with the dawn of the new administration. Mary, you say this technology is here to stay, and you compare teaching kids how to use these things properly is like teaching them how to drive a car, which we certainly do, and for good reason. So have you been involved in those efforts?
Not directly, but indirectly. I have been promoting media literacy and digital literacy since I was president of a division of the American Psychological Association on media psychology and technology. So back in 2011, which now just seems so long ago, you know, one of my platforms was internet safety because the cell phones were not really in use. So we were talking about how do you make children use these more responsibly, and how do families cope with it, right? Because it's a much bigger situation. And I was surprised that even back then, the literature showed that children who use the internet, this is prior to cell phone use, whose parents monitored and engaged them and had communication with them, were actually more resilient, and who actually then could talk about what was now we call fake news versus real news. You know, just because something, as you said, is online doesn't mean it's true. And I'll just add, AI is now going to take a whole nother level on all of this. And as a psychologist and clinician, I'm constantly asking, particularly middle school and teen, but even fourth and fifth graders, what sites do you visit? Can you tell me? Can you show me? So that I can learn what it is that they're dealing with. And I think parents are, the communication is critical.
Krista.
Yeah, I'll just add to what Mary said, because I appreciate her bringing this question of AI and deep fakes into the conversation. And certainly this is something we get asked about a lot at the Friday Institute as well. And what I'll bring to this as an animating idea might be around this conversation around propaganda, right? That in some ways, it may not matter if something is being faked or not, or if it's real or not. The idea is that we teach kids how to recognize propaganda, how to recognize when something leaves your feed that is requiring you to have or eliciting an emotional response to you, from you, and how to navigate that, reflect on it, and critically evaluate any source of media that comes into your view.
We've talked about how technology always poses problems, challenges. I remember when there was a great controversy over the use of calculators as opposed to slide rules in classrooms, and the fact that teachers would allow calculators to be used in math tests and final exams. We went through all of that, and guess what? The world still spins on its axis, or its axis. We have computers in the classroom. Now we have cell phones. Do we need the cell phones if we have the computers? What's the difference? Is this any different, Krista, from all these other things that we've debated over the years?
Well, I think as adults, we are prone to kind of doing what you've just said, Mike, which is looking back and saying, you know, we turned out okay and we didn't have access to any of these things. And with a little bit of curiosity, I would just add to this conversation, you know, kids do not use cell phones as a form of communication or as a form of accessing information as a replacement. They're not doing it to do the same things we would do, but we would talk to each other. This is their form of communication. This is their form of accessing media. The way that information comes to you on a cell phone in a certain kind of app is not always the same way that it might come to you through a computer. And so as we think about the kinds of performance and knowledge and learning that we want to ask kids to engage in, we do have reason to believe that sometimes in some limited uses, cell phones are delivering something that a computer cannot. And let's keep having the conversation and engaging
meaningfully. Give me an example of what cell phones can deliver that a computer cannot.
Note-taking apps. This is not a thing that that a computer can do as easily, right? That when my kid is using a note-taking application and it is syncing across multiple devices, you're adding to an idea. And then there's a sharing functionality of that where kids could build on each other's ideas. But it's not the same kind of...
But Evernote and OneNote are on all platforms known to man.
Absolutely.
So what's the difference? Put it on a
computer.
I think
the difference is the kind of way that you might be accessing the information, the kind of way it might become more assistive to you, it is the moment of access that feels a little bit different. And it is a way to think differently about how we are both producing content, video, art, and a way to think differently about how to communicate and engage.
James, you report that the Granville County, North Carolina superintendent says that since his district implemented strict bans on cell phone use, they've seen drops in discipline rates and suspensions, while former state superintendent of public instruction Kathy Truitt once cautioned against the unintended consequences of outright bans. What are those unintended consequences, and what, if anything, has her successor, Mo Green, had to say in his short time in office about this?
Yeah, what former Superintendent Truitt had talked about was she cautioned against this becoming sort of a divisive issue, something that divides school communities. You know, Krista touched on this a little bit before that, you know, she had said when you create bans, you kind of create different sides, people who feel very strongly for or against it and what that can do to a school community and the kinds of tensions that might add in the classroom. You know, she had also spoken a lot at, I know in December, the state board talked about this at length in a planning session. And she had talked about, too, just the benefits of being a parent and having access to your kid, not just for emergencies, but also like, you know, something got canceled after school or something like that. As for new Superintendent Mo Green, I don't know if he said anything since taking office on this specifically. I know on the campaign trail, he was also, I would say, a little cautious about saying he supported a ban, but definitely talked about this as something that he wanted to explore more and talk to more stakeholders about and look into a little bit more. I know he is planning sort of listening sessions across the state to try to get feedback, and this could be something that comes up in that.
I have 45 seconds left, James. And one of the arguments is that parents want to be able to get in touch with their children and vice versa should something arise that would be considered an emergency. I know that you are not a lawyer, but have you heard any concerns expressed by administrators that they might be held liable should a situation arise where cell phones would have been beneficial, but students have been denied access to them?
I have not personally heard that level of concern. And I think that many of the schools that have these policies in place usually have some sort of way for kids to contact their parents or access their phone in the case of an emergency or something serious like that. But I haven't heard that specific concern.
And I had 10 seconds. Are we teaching children how to use these properly where they are allowed? Do we know, James?
I think it varies by school. Since there's so many different policies like we've been talking about, I think it varies.
James Farrell is our education reporter here at WFAE News. Krista Glazewski is executive director of the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State. And Mary Alford is a psychologist with Alfred Baker and Associates. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.